This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. And so fired up for today are one of our favorite kind of recurring guests on the show, Professor Tom Davidoff. He is associate professor at UBC Sauder School of Business, real estate talking head expert, Vancouver real estate expert, overall just an economist people want to talk to.
You know what? I feel like Tom's a guy that people want to talk to there. He's also a guy that people want to listen to because he's whip smart. He has so many interesting takes on the market. And today's conversation is no exception. We talk the liberal minority government that was just elected, what it means to have an economist at the helm. Guy that went to the same school as Tom at one point. We talk about investors, tariffs, uncertainty, what the market's going to do in the next couple months, what's it going to do in the next 1, 3, and 5 years. Tom always sticks his neck out. And his prediction on this year is kind of interesting for the rest of the year and into the next year. So stay tuned for that. But tons to dig into today with past guest fan favorite Tom Davidoff.
Yeah, and I'm super excited about this. And I actually didn't get to join the conversation. There was a bit of a scheduling conflict, but you speak with Tom. One thing is most people watch the election. I watched the CBC coverage, Vancouver coverage. Really kind of a entertaining night. I was expecting it to take longer before the Liberals were declared victorious. But then, of course, the minority government, which was maybe some would argue unfortunate. But here's the thing. The other thing that was surprising, Jagmeet Singh lost his ride,
yeah,
as did PP.
So, I know.
It was kind of a wild night.
It was. I couldn't. Well, Jagmeet, that was a disaster for the NDP. There's no way to frame that. And I guess the Conservatives had a great showing, but if you went back to where they were in January, I'd say it's hard to argue that it wasn't a bit of a disaster in some respects as well, especially for PP.
Yeah, and regardless of how you feel about the new prime minister, there's some pretty amazing videos of him dancing at after parties. That's making
I saw that. Around. Oh my god,
I thought that was AI for a while. I was like, no, this is AI. This is a smear campaign. But that's apparently real. It's apparently how he dances. And
so he's a
better
first
politician.
Anyways, yeah.
All right. And this podcast is sponsored, of course, by Scalina Real Estate, which is our real estate team in Vancouver. And I believe you have a trivia question for the segment that remains nameless.
That's right. For the segment that remains nameless, I have a question for you. It's a timely one. You know, sometimes I go deep. Sometimes it's ripped from the headlines. I would say that is this this quiz question for you. Oh, I'm going to read it out here.
I don't read the news these days.
Former Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson won a parliamentary seat in the riding of Fraser View South Burnaby. Adam, I'm pretty sure you're aware that Gregor Robertson won after initially not planning to run in the federal election. His candidacy only happened after being persuaded by who?
Oh, boy.
Do you remember his wife's name?
No. But was it his wife?
Hey, before you make any guess, Adam, let's cut to this week's listing, which is a fantastic one.
Right. Oh, boy. You might have spoiled it there. Okay. So this week, we have such an incredible new listing that just went live. on MLS. And of course, at our real estate website, which is scalinarealestate.com and the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.com. This one is super exciting in Kitsilano, Matt, one of my favorite neighborhoods in the
north
city.
North of 4th.
North of 4th, absolutely. And completely renovated. And it's funny, like, I mean, there's different levels of renovation in this
That's
city.
Right.
And everybody's familiar with that. This is what I would say is a really high level, beautiful, thoughtful renovation in a one bedroom north of 4th. Building's fantastic. It's been fully rain screened with a newer roof, windows, balconies. This is obviously, you got all the shops and cafes along 4th and Broadway, your blocks to the beach. This is a large one bedroom, 660 square feet with parking and storage. And you can learn all about it over at our website. And man, overhead ceilings, it feels amazing in there. This is one of the nicer one bedrooms I've seen in a long time. So go
That's
check
right.
out at Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. And the list price is $729,900.
That's right, $729,900. You can see that at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. While you're there, click Sell With Us, where you can download our most downloaded document of all time, the sold plan that start on launch date. It's an immediate download at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But Adam, I think everybody's waiting for this answer. So just to remind everyone, former Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson won a parliamentary seat in the riding of Fraser View South Burnaby after initially not planning to run in the federal election. His candidacy only happened after being persuaded by who?
Yeah, I don't remember her name. I can picture her in my mind, but I don't remember her name, but I'm going to guess his wife.
It was Mark Carney, Adam. It was Mark Carney.
Oh, you threw me for... Oh, man, that was so strategic.
Mark Carney personally called her former mayor, Gregor Robertson,
and
requested that he run for the Liberal Party of Canada, and he won that seat just days ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I honestly, I'm not kidding. I've been trying to avoid the news lately. I need a little R&R.
Yeah. But,
why don't we cut to this conversation with Tom Davidoff? Because I do need some insight on what's going on in this market. And hopefully, Matt, you know, as a lot of people have been saying recently, buyers, the election was the objection, but now the election is over. Do we see an uptick in the market? Stay tuned.
Absolutely. And enjoy this conversation with Tom.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
Adam, we want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Soane House, one of Marcon's latest communities that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced, Nordic-inspired design for architecture that endures.
Soane House offers 165 junior one to three bedroom homes in West Coquitlam, integrating nature into the built environment.
Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's marcon.ca/soenhaus, or visit the display center at Outpost in Port Moody.
We also want to highlight 102 and Park. With billions already invested in Surrey City's central development over the last 15 years, the time is now to invest in its future, Surrey 3.0.
Introducing 102 and Park, a simple, straightforward skyscraper featuring 376 homes. Quite simply, this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity coming soon to Surrey's central downtown plaza. This is a time and the place to invest. Register at marcon.ca/102andpark. That's marcon.ca/102and. P-A-R-K.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with associate professor at the UBC Sauder School of Business and past guest fan favorite, Tom Davidoff. How you doing, Tom?
Doing great. Thanks very much. You?
Yeah, no, doing well. It's been an exciting couple of days, so we're happy you have the time to come on and chat about the election and the market and tariffs and whatever else we get into here.
Yeah, you know, we got a Gen X Harvard grad, balding PhD economist, so I can't say I'm too disappointed in that.
Fantastic. Well, maybe before we get to that, can you start by reminding our listeners who you are by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I just described myself a little bit, but yeah, I'm an economist at the Sauder School of Business, where I teach real estate finance, sometimes urban econ, managerial economics. I do research academically in the area mostly of housing economics. I've done some stuff on aging, life annuities, and reverse mortgage. You know, try to dabble in housing policy here and there where I feel like I can be helpful.
So yeah, maybe getting right to it, and you maybe showed your cards a little bit there, but we have what appears to be, and we're talking, what is this, Tuesday morning after the election. It looks like there's a liberal minority government with Mark Carney leading. What are your thoughts on the election?
Well, I think it's about what people expected. If anything, I think the conservatives outperformed a little bit last night. You know, we had a bit of an office. There was no money at stake, but three of us made predictions and we all had the liberals with majorities, I think, just based on what we were seeing in polling and, you know, aggregators like 338 Canada. So the conservatives outperformed a little bit, but, you know, about what was expected. Again, you know, as an economist, I am excited to see how it goes with Carney. I think he's got a good background for the moment, but he is in a very tough situation. And, you know, he was dealt great cards in terms of the election, but in terms of policy, he's certainly facing a lot of challenges.
Is there, you know, now that you mention that, and I wasn't really putting the two and two together here, getting you on to talking about an economist being the prime minister, I'm trying to think of other situations where economists, is this like a really good barometer for, hey, let's see how somebody who really knows how the machine works can run the country? Or are there other examples that you can think of?
I mean, my instinct is in difficult situations, I think almost like an airplane pilot. Like I was once in a terrible car accident and I didn't do a great job. I don't know that I would, you know, I'm an economist, but I don't know that I can handle stress and crisis. I think leadership, calm under pressure, obviously, I think a high IQ helps. But, you know, I would say probably the Goldman Sachs and the central bank head almost would be the more important background. I think it's great to have expertise in government, but I think somebody with a high IQ and good judgment and a good manager of people can have economists and make decisions based on their input. But that having been said, you know, I'm sure he's going to have, I'm pretty confident he'll have good policy instincts.
So which party in your mind was best for housing, I guess in Canada, but more specifically, of course, in Vancouver?
Well, I'm going to confine it to the Liberals and Conservatives, you know.
Of course.
The NDP had their usual, like, you know, execute all the landlords or whatever, which was not, I mean, they did want to build housing, which is great. But actually, I thought the Liberals and Conservatives really both had pretty solid housing platforms. You know, they're both talking about some GST rollbacks on owner housing. You know, that's a mixed idea, cost revenue. Hopefully it does stimulate supply a little bit. The conservative plan was simpler, was just waive it up to some price, whereas the Liberals were up to a price limit and only for first-time buyers. And I just don't see the point of that. I don't know why you're building brand new homes for first-time buyers in our most affordability-stressed markets. They're both rolling back capital gains a little bit. I think it might be a wise idea for the Liberals to borrow something from the Conservatives, which is this non-taxation of rolled-over capital gains. Mm-hmm. So I'm some guy who owns a warehouse, and I, you know, somebody wants to offer me tons of money to build condos there. And I say, yeah, you know, I don't want to pay the capital gains tax. I want to just roll this land over into my estate. You know, maybe it gets out tax-free somehow at a later date. But on the other hand, if the guy takes that warehouse funds and buys some other Canadian asset, that's no damage to the Canadian economy. Might cost some revenue here and there, but letting him roll those capital gains over tax-free, from what I've heard from industry, that could really stimulate development. So that was a conservative idea the Liberals didn't mimic, but I think might be worth considering. Where the Liberals are interesting is getting public involvement in construction. There already is, of course, because CMHC is so active in funding rental construction. The rental projects that are happening today, I don't think would work economically without subsidized CMHC insurance and direct lending, you know, at high loan to values. But they're talking about constructing social housing, I think, by government. Generally, I think let the market do the building, and I don't think new housing is the most logical place to put affordable housing. But that having been said, there's two components that I like about the liberal public intervention into the market, which are they're talking about stimulating modular. Now, people have been talking about modular housing as long as I've been an adult, and I don't know why it hasn't taken off more, but maybe it takes public investment because the private sector is too risk averse or nobody has the deep pockets to fund it. So I'm all for that, you know, to some extent. And then the other issue, of course, that we'll get into is this is not a great year for building housing. Rents have fallen due to pulling the plug on immigration, and interest rates are not as low as they have been. So it, to me, makes sense that you might get public build. If you're ever going to do public construction, this is the year to do it.
How does it, in your mind, does that actually look? Because it just, I heard that, and, we've been busy kind of selling real estate. It strikes me as something that, you know, maybe it's a good time to be talking about that, but does that not take years? In my mind, it would take years to actually even start to get a shovel in the ground that's being built by the government. Seems like that's like a decades, not a couple years plan.
You know, it is in the current environment. I think you raise a good point about that. I guess we should pivot to the other issue, which is approvals, right? Both the liberals and conservatives. Why I really like their platform is they're both on top of, look, we got to make sure municipalities don't overcharge, don't take too long in granting approvals for projects. And both, again, the liberals and conservatives said that we can't delegate this to municipalities that don't have the incentive to do it. We're going to, you know, give carrots and sticks to get incentives. So if there's federal land, I mean, look at Sanok. Right. I mean, that project is just kicking right away. That's the First Nations. They didn't need a lot of approvals. The construction's going lickety split. Maybe on federal land, you just tell the local municipality, stay out of the way with the approvals process. We're going to make sure the building's safe. Go hire a local builder. Maybe you can get it going pretty quickly. You know, in World War II, all kinds of public works type stuff was happening pretty quickly. I think even post-war public housing, you didn't have the long delays you have. There's this whole discussion in the States. Ezra Klein is big on this, like just trying to figure out why has the approval processes and you know, building anything just gotten so slow. And you know, maybe there's a way around it, but certainly that is a concern, right? If we get into a recovery in 2 or 3 years, one hopes, and that's when public investment in construction is scaling up, then you're just crowding out probably private development by absorbing all the building trades that otherwise would have gone to private projects.
You know, Tom, if you had to choose one or the other, do you think a kind of the conservative approach of, you know, get out of the way, policy shifts, let the builders who are building housing actually build the homes is a better approach than kind of trying to recreate the wheel in some respects with public housing?
As a general matter, I don't think you want the public sector doing development. I don't see why that has to happen. I think if there's a friendly regulatory and tax environment, construction will happen. And again, yes, there's a need for housing affordability, but making brand new homes the place where you put the affordable homes makes no sense because there's a premium to new homes and it just costs a lot of money to make those the affordable homes. You wind up having lotteries instead of just having, you know, cash grants to people who are struggling with affordability. Everybody gets an equal share and they buy the housing units that make sense for them. The exception is in a recession, right? If the economy stinks, you don't want everybody unemployed, not spending any money, because then the economy cycles down. You want people employed, and government is a natural place to have that employment. And obviously, when you face housing challenges, you know, often it's stuff like building roads and infrastructure, which makes perfect sense, but there's a need for housing. So I don't think it's crazy to do public housing construction in a recession. But as you say, the timing is challenging to the extent that scaling this up is going to take us so long that we'll be out of a recession.
You know, usually we start these conversations, Tom, with the simple question that maybe I'll pivot to now. How's the market? And you usually say, well, you're on the ground, how's the market? But what are your thoughts?
Yeah. And first of all, I should be careful, you know, to the extent my colleagues hear this, they'll say, what are you talking about recession? We're not in a recession. Obviously, the States isn't Canada, maybe flirting with it, but, you know, I don't think we're there yet. But for construction, I don't think things are going great at all from what I've heard. I don't think condo pre-sales work. And the reason for that isn't complicated. Condos aren't worth what they were a few years ago. Why? Immigration is less, so the level of rents is lower. I think we'll probably pick up immigration again, but the growth prospects were amazing a few years ago. There was no way construction was going to keep up with population growth. And that meant, you know, ad infinitum rent growth in an era when we had interest rates of like 1.5% and low interest rates. That makes condos super valuable. People want to buy them, then developers respond by building them. Today, we have less growth, higher interest rates, so they're just not as valuable as they were. And typically, construction happens when prices are at an all-time high. When you're well below the value you had a few years ago, you're just not going to see starts. Where you do see some starts is in the rental sector because CMHC has provided such discounted financing. But even there, I don't think activity is as high as it has been. So that's the construction sector. Looking at sales, I should have looked at the Vancouver Real Estate Board before I started, but I think they've been pretty slow. You can tell me. I feel like the last couple of weeks I've seen a bit of a pickup, but you know, we're heading into spring. In fact, we're a little late for the spring pickup that you would usually see. So I think things have probably picked up, if I had to guess, from February, but probably less so than in a typical year. In terms of sectors, I think condos weak. Toronto, it's not as bad as I would have. Toronto could be a real catastrophe because they're still finishing buildings where prices on the market, the spot price today is way less, I believe, than what people paid for pre-sales. You know, you usually pay more than the market for pre-sale. And then if the market falls, you just got a big gap. People don't want to close. I think there's going to be a ton of unsold inventory. I think the problem's a little bit less here in Vancouver because we had more rental relative to condo and probably just overall less quantity and maybe the market's less weak. But I think it's tough. Single family, I just can't imagine there's a ton of trade up happening. A friend of mine, you know, a West Side realtor told me just very low sales in the luxury single family segment. But you tell me where I'm off.
No, you sound it all sounds bang on to me. You know, I've actually been out of town for the last couple of weeks, so you know, my senses were kind of the uncertainty has kind of become a bit normalized and the market's kind of picked up a bit. Yeah. But really when the tariff talk started in February, I felt like we were kind of achieving liftoff. And then, you know, February, March were the numbers, the sales volume just crashed. So we're starting from a very tough spot. But yeah, it does feel like the last couple of weeks, there's a little bit more movement in the market, but it's people that have to move right now that are moving through the market, right? It's not, there's definitely not a ton of investors out there, and it's kind of really like that meat and potatoes, growing families, people that are driving traffic.
Yeah, family makes sense. I mean, you know, for young people, the urgency has just got to be reduced because the rental market has gotten softer, and I think it's going to continue to. I mean, you know, that Sonat completion, that's a lot of units you're going to dump. And there's some others happening. I've certainly seen it. I think was going for 3,000 for basement suites. I think, you know, I've even seen 2,450 on the west side. That's probably a bit steeper. And I don't know what rents are, what's happening to rents downtown, but I'm confident rents are softening for rollovers.
So I'm just thinking here, rents are softening. We've already kind of touched on the fact that the immigration kind of taps been shut off. There's a lot of completions around Metro Vancouver that sold kind of 2021, maybe early 2022 that are coming, you know, to completion here. And some have already completed.
I mean, Oak Ridge is going to be like Silence of the Lambs, right?
Well, this is what I'm thinking. Like, what in your mind, and I'm thinking back to your days consulting at the White House, like, what does absorption look like here? How long does this take to kind of get back to a scenario where there's just not, where the listing count isn't astronomical in relation to kind of a normal Vancouver context?
I mean, I think it probably depends in part on sellers and landlords. I don't think landlords are going to sit on empty rentals. Rents can adjust down. And obviously, there's plenty of room. And the other, there's plenty of demand. There's a lot of kids in parents' basements who would like to get out. And I think that tap is sensitive. The flow of kids out of parents' basements is quite sensitive to rents. So, you know, you look at my colleagues, Jens von Bergman and Nathan Loster have looked, and, you know, places like in Quebec, you just get people forming households significantly younger than in Toronto and Vancouver because there's just less housing pressure. So the rental units will get absorbed. For sale, the condos, you know, I don't know how that shakes out. You know, if you have a giant building unsold, do you start renting units rather than take an L on the price? I don't know. And I don't know for how long. I will say, I think, I don't know how big of a factor it can be. I do think the opportunity is there to ramp up immigration again. The way it was handled, it was not perfect, right? You had this giant acceleration with just too many new people coming for the amount of housing that was getting built. I think the right choice would have been to scale up housing earlier. You know, Trudeau knew there were problems, and they did start the CMHC financing, and they did start kicking around municipalities to do more approvals, but that started a little bit late. You know, 2015, if they, you know, shot the starting gun on supply, then maybe you could have absorbed the immigrants, which I think is the best case because it's great to let people have the opportunity to live here. And of course, it's great for the real estate industry, but bad for affordability when you let in immigrants. Now we have such an opportunity. I mean, you know, the Trump administration, I think, equates a PhD in the sciences with having those like teardrop tattoos in terms of, you know, how much
they suspect people of. Can end up in El Salvador.
Exactly. So I'd rather, you know, teach at UBC than in torture prison in El Salvador. And, you know, undergrads, right? I'm confident there are some very smart kids who think, I don't know that I want to build my future in the U.S., who we could poach as students today. So I think for the future of Canada, for the good of the planet, I think turning up the immigration in a managed way would certainly help with absorption.
You know, just thinking about the situation we've just outlined here. So we're talking about, you know, Mark Carney's platform, I think, was talking around 500,000 homes a year being built. There's this kind of government component, but also obviously trying to incentivize the private sector to get building again. At the same time, we're talking about lower rents. We're talking about completions from 2021 that are not being absorbed. I just saw, I think it was a rates.ca poll that showed that 30% of Canadians that used to think condos were a good investment don't believe they are any longer a good investment. How did we get to this kind of miserable spot we're in? And is any of this, is really like, how do we get out of it, I guess, in your mind?
Well, it's a great question. You know, I get media questions like, you know, how are we going to deal with the housing crisis? How do we get enough units built? And, you know, right now, it's still not affordable, but rents are not accelerating up.
Mm-hmm.
But they were. So I think the, I don't know what you call it, seesaw, roller coaster path of immigration, where you had intense immigration, and then you just pull the plug. That was terrible for the higher education sector where I work, right? Because foreign students are an important form of financing for educational institutions. And you had built up all this reliance, and then you just pull the plug very quickly, which doesn't work. And the housing market, similarly, you know, you tell the building industry, essentially, with that rapid rate of immigration, there is plenty of demand, go build. And then you say, okay, great that you started these units, so now we're going to pull the plug. So I think you have to, you know, manage the rate of immigration in a more stable way. But I think they've got to increase a little bit. They should. And I think there's room with the real estate sector to do it now because governments are on side. The other issue in terms of how we got here, of course, is interest rates, which did the same thing as immigration, right? You had incredibly low interest rates, which I think people generally thought were here to stay. Then we got those weird supply disruptions and inflation during COVID. Banks had to start raising rates and go from, like, I don't know, 1.5 to 6 or something like that in a short period. That's devastating for affordability and kills prices. It just lowers the value of condos. And in the short run, people can't make payments. So that leads to the boomerang. And then the third thing, of course, is Trump with this unbelievable own goal on tariffs. Everything was fine. I mean, he inherited a great economy. The stock market's actually, you know, coming back a bit from that because things are basically really good. The U.S. was not even remotely close to a recession. And then he does this crazy random stuff, which makes it impossible for businesses to plan and invest in the U.S., let alone in Canada, where you have the uncertainty over fortunes of the U.S. economy. But moreover, you have, you know, possibility that you can't sell goods in the U.S. anymore. So just bananas. So, you know, tariffs, interest rates, and the path of immigration, I think, are certainly enough to the position we're in, where everybody was hysterical that we need more supply. And all of a sudden, the industry really starts to dwindle. The industry starts to dwindle is a bad expression, but, you know.
Well, actually, you know what? But it does make me think of kind of, you know, our conversation on pricing, because everything here suggests that we've talked about so far suggests downward pressure on pricing, at least in the condo market, in my mind, right? And yet, you know, there's talk about the inflationary effects of the tariffs and especially on kind of specific components of building new housing. Is there any world, or maybe I'll just put it to you this way, Tom, and this is not the, I'll save the real forecasting for the end, but is there a world in which new housing prices continue to rise, all other housing is static, or there's actually downward pressure?
Yeah, I mean, higher construction costs is a reduction in supply, and that leads to higher prices. So that is a possibility that new construction is just going to stop, right? I mean, it isn't so much that units will be more expensive. You'll have very little new construction because of the increase in cost. And, you know, yeah, in the short run, I think that has a moderate effect. But, you know, a couple of years down the road, you'll see the effect of that on housing prices. The other thing, though, I would say that comes with possible recession is low interest rates. So Canada, you know, during the great financial crisis, we had a bit of a dip in prices, but really not bad at all. And then a big rush back because rates came down. And I think there is room for central banks to lower rates. The complication with tariffs is, well, you don't want to cut rates when you have inflation. But the reason you don't want to cut rates when you have inflationary pressure is that you don't want consumers to go out and spend. Because when consumers go out and spend, that pushes up inflation. With tariff-induced inflation, it's a different story. You don't have a problem of excess demand. You just have high prices because of a tax wedge. And in that environment, I'm not sure at all that you don't want to go ahead and cut rates. I had hoped the bank would go a quarter point lower in the last meeting. And it is very believable to me that they're going to decide to make a couple more rate cuts this year.
Best guess on that, on interest rates then? You're thinking a couple of quarter points?
Yeah, I don't know. But if we were a half point lower at the end of the year, I wouldn't be surprised.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible. This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Event Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a Caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down.
If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
You know, the other thing I was going to ask is just a general economic forecast here. And I know we're in a, you know, we have a little bit more certainty around that we just got out of the election. Of course, there's a lot of uncertainty in the market in general. How do you see the next kind of 6 to 12 months playing out? I know you mentioned recession. We're not, I guess, technically there yet. We've talked a little bit about interest rates, inflation, even a trade deal. What are your thoughts on how this all plays out?
Yeah, you know, Trump could dig himself out. You know, Trump sort of has, I guess they called it the Bernanke or the Greenspan put. The problem I have is Trump sort of has a call option on the economy. I don't think he wants to let things get too bad because then he loses power. But, you know, his big play is he wants stuff, you know, he wants to, you know, get bribes or whatever, and he wants to be a big shot and give stuff to his friends. And that stinks up the economy. He also wants to do tariffs and punish brown-skinned people. But, you know, there's a constraint. He can only do so much of it because the market throws a tantrum. The problem is, I think if the market gets good enough, he's going to say, all right, well, there's no more constraint. I can go do my thing again. So there's a limit to how good things can get. And there really is a risk. You know, Doge fired everybody competent in the U.S. government. So, you know, and these secretaries, right, like Kennedy, if there's some kind of a another epidemic or any kind of world crisis, the U.S. is not in a good place to manage crisis competently. And so there's always, you know, something will go wrong in the next few years. I don't know when, but that's going to be a problem because it won't be managed well. That having been said, he can dig himself out of this mess by slowly, you know, deleting tariffs and, you know, claiming victories and making up concessions that other countries made. I kind of think that's somewhat likely because I just don't think the Republicans want to see themselves get obliterated in the midterm elections, which is the path they're on right now. So I think we could see good news with tariffs. If we don't see good news with tariffs again, I do think we're going to see rate cuts. And I also think the opportunity and the need is here to pick up the pace on immigration again. So, you know, I'm not terribly bearish on the next year for the housing market.
Interesting. So you think, is it then about, I mean, apart from, you know, interest rate cuts potentially leading to more sales, is it more about just kind of like I said, internalizing this level of uncertainty and kind of going about your daily life and making life decisions?
Yeah, the fundamentals of the U.S. and Canadian economies were pretty good before the tariff stuff started. Canada was a little rougher because of the immigration and the interest rates and our maybe greater reliance on the real estate sector. But we don't need this uncertainty and craziness with trade. There's no objective need for it from the U.S. where they're at full employment. You know, a friend of mine said he was talking to some CEO, and the CEO said, what are you talking about onshoring jobs? I can't hire people as it is. Like, I can't find labor, right? They're almost at full employment. They don't need to stop importing so that people can find jobs. That's bananas. So, you know, they say things that can't happen won't happen. So is Trump really going to just, you know, completely torpedo production, investment, all that stuff to prove a point? I think, you know, maybe tariffs will set a little, right? That said, he's crazy. So I don't know, right? There's a world in which the tariff stuff is a total killer. And I mean, Ontario is worse than BC, right? I think BC's, you know, manufacturing exports to the US, it's a thing, but I think it's a lot less. Ontario, that's like a horror show. And, you know, there's a world in which their pain is our gain, because I think, again, you know, if you get into a terrible recession, you do get rate cuts. And if the employment situation isn't as bad in BC as it is in Ontario, but we get rate cuts, you know, demand for real estate is very rate sensitive because of the affordability and the valuation issues.
I was surprised recently, and I guess it was a couple months ago now, that the NDP, and I think it was actually the Premier, made some overtures in Victoria to the real estate community, you know, talking about investors in a way that was different than then they've been talked about for a number of years, I guess coming on close to a decade, it feels like. What are your thoughts there? I know it's kind of an interesting moment, but is the NDP pivoting? Does it make as much sense for them to pivot as it seems to me? What is your take?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the combination of a foreign buyer ban or foreign buyer tax, when you already have empty homes and speculation taxes, it's beyond overkill. I think it can be counterproductive. How can it be counterproductive? Look, if somebody from America or China or wherever buys a condo in Vancouver and leaves it empty, well, that's bad for local affordability. If they buy a condo pre-sale and then sell it, they're actually stimulating supply and they're never occupying a unit. So they're acting as just like a pension fund or a limited partner or a pre-sale buyer. They're financing construction, and that's a good thing, and that should be embraced. And Ravi Kalyan are both smart guys, so I don't see why they would fail to see that. And Carney is certainly a smart guy, and I don't see why he would fail to see that. Even condo buyers, you know, the top floor penthouse is like the opposite of a loss leader, as I understand it. It's a gain leader, right? You might have a condo project that, you know, doesn't really work on the first 24 floors, but floors 25 and 26, the super grande penthouse that you may not sell domestically, that can make the project work. So to the extent that you have like obscenely rich luxury buyers from overseas, you know, buying empty penthouses, that probably actually increases affordability locally by making projects work. Now, how do you distinguish that from the guy building on the 30th floor, you know, buying on the 15th floor, just an Airbnb unit? I don't know exactly, but I think the empty homes and speculation tax really handle those empty units pretty well. And I think there are creative ways to embrace foreign investment in supply that don't really detract from local demand.
Do you think it's politically possible? I mean,
yes. In this environment, I think, hey, we need to close our borders and stop foreign people from acting in our economy probably has a lot less grip on the population than it did before Trump got elected.
Yeah, I like your idea. And, you know, a couple people have said it on the show about really taking advantage of this moment, right? That Canada, from in your business, and it's not a business, the business of educating bright people from around the world, including Canada, but in our business as well, in the business of growing the Canadian economy, it does seem like we're in a moment where if we act decisively, quickly, and intelligently, we can really take advantage of a series of blunders in the U.S.
I mean, there is a lot of talent in the U.S. that I know is giving serious thought to the question of, do I stay or go? And I mean, this is a really different group running the U.S. than we've seen before. I mean, this isn't, you know, Ronald Reagan, you know, cutting taxes. I mean, this is, you know, really shifting what democracy and civil rights are. You know, you never know. I mean, I think people in Germany in 1939 were on the fence and they said, ah, come on, how bad is it going to be? You know, this is a free and, you know, civil country. Nothing too bad can happen. You don't want to make that mistake. But I mean, I don't know, if you're a lawyer in America or a tech guy, you're going to make better money in the States. You don't want to uproot your family just because you don't like the party that won. So, you know, are you crazy to think you ought to come to Canada? I think there's enough Americans who might make the bet I would come here. For an undergrad, it's an easy choice. For somebody doing a PhD, and for some professionals, I think they're going to make that decision. So the opportunity to poach talent is so good that I think we ought to be doing it aggressively. And, you know, that's true for countries all over the world. And that's what Canada was doing for years and years. But I think we sort of may have thrown the baby out along with the bathwater by getting a little bit draconian on immigration because of the affordability crisis that it engendered.
You know, Tom, if you could wave a magic wand and, let's say, change three policies at the municipal, provincial, or federal level, what would they be? And I was going to say, obviously, in relation to housing, but now that we're talking about, you know, kind of broader issues, maybe, you know, top three.
Yeah, so let's start with municipal. Like, let's get real in Vancouver with the city plan and with one, just to pick one, multiplex. The density is too low with multiplex, and there's no site assembly options. So I'll give you an example. I have a property next to a 60-foot lot, and on the 60-foot lot, it was this old house with beautiful old trees, and they scraped the trees, which is a tragedy. Those were great old trees. Okay, that's fine. Let's build some housing. And they built two pairs of duplexes on basically two 30-foot lots. And on this block, there's a bunch of houses that could easily have been assembled that are older homes. It would have made great sense to do, you know, mid-rise apartment or townhomes. No reason not to do that in, on a busy street. But, you know, there's just no option to do it. They have not gotten serious about missing middle or high-rise or anything beyond the Broadway plan. So the council needs to, you know, get up off their pull-up bar or whatever, and get serious about implementing the Vancouver plan, which I think, you know, I had an exchange with the city planner on Blue Sky and Josh White, I think, and you know, he said this stuff's going to get implemented, but I don't know when. Let's get going with it. Okay, so that's the municipal level. Provincial, you know, I think I guess I would just crack the whip a little bit more effectively on getting multiplex implemented across jurisdictions. There are infrastructure issues, and they do have to be thought out. But I think municipalities are ragging on implementing both transit-oriented development and multiplex. I think probably multiplex, I would guess, in the next couple of years is maybe the bigger priority, because small-scale projects probably pencil better than the grande transit-oriented stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, bills 44 through 47 were great. They said, hey, municipalities, you have to do these things. You can't have single family zoning, and you have to allow high density near transit. But as I like to say, you know, that's like telling your kids you have to make your bed. What do you mean you have to make your bed? They don't have to make their bed. What are you going to do? They'll say, I am. Give me a break. It takes time, right?
Well, you know, and just thinking about that, we had somebody on the show not long ago, I'm blanking on who it was. Actually, it was Jack Bernard from Rennie, who was saying they're talking to people who have developers who have land near transit that are actually not building to the potential because it just pencils better to do wood frame, six story. So it's an interesting moment where, you know, the government basically gives these the floor space ratio ramps up in every other moment. It's like, oh my God. And in this moment, they're turning it down.
And then at the federal level, but it could be the provincial or the local level, I'd give a real rethink to how we do affordability mandates. You know, the CMHC rental project that didn't work and they wanted to do six-story wood instead may well be because of an onerous affordability requirement. And I am all for taking profits from development and giving it to needy people. But the way you give profits from development to needy people is, one, you don't make it so onerous that there's no profits. You don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And number two, you don't have lotteries for affordable units in otherwise luxurious buildings in great locations. You take the profits. You say, hey, you know, you're going to do this deal from us. We need some cash, or we charge a little bit higher interest rates. No affordability requirement, but we take the profits and we, you know, help homeless people struggling with addiction on the street, which would be great to do anyway as a humanitarian thing. And also, I think probably for the real estate market, it would be good. We need it. I mean, you can't have cities with the amount of desperation and drug use that we have. Just as a human issue, as a social issue, it's a total loser. So, you know, that's where I'd spend the money. I wouldn't spend it on subsidizing firefighters and teachers who can afford something okay, getting something great. It just doesn't make any sense at all. You're not helping those in greatest need. So, yeah, that would be that. I would rethink affordability requirements and how we extract value from development.
Fantastic. Well, before we get to the forecast, you know, I think, well, I had this question. Maybe you've kind of talked a little bit about it, but let's put it this way. Compared to a lot of people we've had on the show recently, I feel like your take on the rest of the year is slightly more optimistic than many, which feels like a warm hug right now. So I appreciate that. But what's the headline? If there's a headline for Vancouver real estate for 2025, best guess?
Well, now I've updated down because of what you said. So I don't know where we are today. I'm going to say from today, next year, minus 2%, single, it's worse. It's worse. The problem is, you know, it takes time to adjust. I don't know, -4% single family, -6% condo. I want to say zero. You know what? I'm going to stick my neck out. I'm going to say zero change on both and through.
So we're flat. We're just to be clear, we're flat in over the course of the next year.
Yeah, I'd say dip and then a bump. I'd say dip. You know, probably realistically in the fall, but we're up next spring.
Do you think there's, and this is just, I'm just thinking here, like we've talked a little bit about investors and I think your position's pretty clear. And I feel like it's always been pretty clear. I go back to when you were on the show in 2016, I think, talking about Robinson Crusoe, a memorable framing of the issue. Is there a world in which we get back to maybe not the mania or the kind of levels of speculation that we had? And I don't necessarily mean that in a pejorative way, but is there a world in which we get back to where you know, real estate is this thing that people are talking about at dinner parties? We have a really robust investment climate in Vancouver. It kind of feels more like it did, say, 4 or 5 years ago. Is it possible to get back there?
Yeah, I mean, you ramp up immigration, done deal, and so that's really the big consideration. The question mark I have is the pre-sale segment, and I don't want to diss pre-sales. A lot of people have made a lot of money on them over a long period. Investing in Vancouver real estate has made a lot of sense, but why is a mom and pop couple with a net worth of $1.5 million outbidding a pension fund or a Saudi wealth fund that can manage a building at scale, has economies of scale, can be risk neutral because they've got a very diversified portfolio, instead of one couple putting all their money on a single unbuilt condo in a single location where they depend on the Vancouver market, on the developer's skill, on a lot of idiosyncratic factors, and they're putting all their eggs in one basket? So I do not get why that's true. And so I think, you know, somehow taking the pre-sale risk off of individuals and onto diversified institutional investors in the long run makes a lot of sense. But that doesn't kill the excitement over Vancouver real estate. Maybe the flips are on existing properties rather than pre-sales.
Yeah, because in that case, would it be, you'd basically be relying on the financing, but they'd be selling it at completion then to individuals?
Yeah, so I mean, take Addy, which is an interesting entity. They're selling little sips. So I can take not a lot of money and buy a pre-sale unit, but I can take a little bit of money and invest in Matt's development project. But Matt's going to sell the units pre-sale before construction starts and finance construction that way. Why aren't the Addy investors getting a little more juice and carrying their investment through the completion of the project? So speculating on the market for another couple of years, right? I think those investors who put a small fraction of their wealth are in a better position to take the risk of how long it takes for the building to complete and how good the market is at the time it completes and how good of a job the developer does. I think a diversified investor is in a much better position and should outbid, should pay more to hold the property during the construction period. It really puzzles me why the LPs or some institutions aren't riding it out through spec. I understand you want to have financing for construction, so maybe there's some kind of leverage issue. Mm-hmm. But I think that's something I would like to see thought out a little better. Certainly, at least, why not let people buy shares in a fund that buys pre-sales? Why don't I own a little bit of every pre-sale unit instead of all of one? And the answer I've heard is, well, you, Tom, want control and decide whether you're going to sell the unit at completion or rent it out. I don't buy that. I mean, I could buy a fund and the fund could, you know, I could have a fund that holds. I could have some money in a fund that flips. But, you know, I think that's manageable.
Food for thought. Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Tom. We do have a segment called the Five Wire. I think you're familiar with it. Five quick questions. You have time to stick around for that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The Five Wire is brought to you by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been recognized as Multifamily Home Builder of the Year for 10 years in a row and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with 2 fitness areas, 3 children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's ATLINcondos.ca.
Some are the same and some are specific to you and some are different. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes here. But it's always good to get a book recommendation from you, Tom. One book you've read recently you'd recommend.
Oh, I'm in the middle of Austerlitz. I think it's pretty good. My wife really liked it. So I'm going to say Austerlitz. You know, I've got a book club I'm in. I haven't loved everything. My one family member, in fact, just said, oh, you've got to read this book, Orbital. And we read that for book club and my review was Borbital. But a lot of people like that one.
Do you read, like, say, Mark Carney's book? Have you read that? Would you ever pick that up?
You know, it's interesting. I like books about dictators, you know, history of, you know, various authoritarians. But, you know, some politicians, you know, I typically rather read an economics article than a glossy history. You know, I read Obama's autobiography. Jimmy Carter's diaries from the White House are pretty good. So I don't want to say I never do.
All right.
You know, like Pierre Polyev, like, I don't know, How to Troll on Twitter, whatever he wrote, you know.
Fair enough. One restaurant in Vancouver that you think more people should know about?
You know, I'm the last person anybody should ask about that. I'm so bored. I went to Nuba with some friends. I always love Nuba.
Well,
don't listen
it.
To me.
Now, usually we ask about favorite band or music. I know you've mentioned some YouTube videos. So is there something on YouTube you want to recommend?
You know, I'm going to go with, I listen to a lot of George Benson and Fleetwood Mac, but I'm going to go a little off menu. There's I think ABBA is a little underrated. You know, they were sort of a joke when, you know, post-disco era, but I think they're pretty darn clever. So I'm going to tell people to listen to Gimme, 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 which somehow that was an ABBA song I wasn't aware of. I think that might be their best too. That's a banger.
Oh yeah. That's interesting. I feel like now it's in my head already and I'm not a fan. That's, but I'll check it out. Have you been binge watching anything or a favorite movie or movie recommendation?
I am currently rewatching The Americans, and that is so good. So good. Such good acting, you know, good actors physically, you know, great direction. Just a great series. Well, now but a little more au courant. I liked White Lotus 1. I watched the beginning of White Lotus 2 and hated it. White Lotus 3 was fantastic. Fantastic.
I agree.
We binged The Pit, you know, very good, but a little bit too much of saying it instead of showing it by the end. So I'm going to go with White Lotus.
Sorry, The Pit?
The Pit, yeah. It's Noah Wiley. Like, where's he been for 20 years? You know, he has the same thing. He's a doctor in an emergency room, but it is good stuff. Very dramatic. It's like 24, because like it's like each episode is an hour in the life of this hospital. Very, very good. But, you know, The White Lotus is really something special.
Last but not least, Tom, season 3. Yeah, no, that's one of those 3 that I've seen. But The Americans, I feel like, has been on the list forever. I just haven't got around to it, but I think
you haven't seen it?
No.
Now I'm watching the last season. Watch out for Arkady Ivanovich. He's sort of he's a subtle character, but he's like my hero. So professional, always shows up, well-dressed, in charge. When I start my work day, I'm like, I'm going to be like Arkady Ivanovich today. I never am, but solid. He's solid.
Okay. Last but not least, if you had to start your career over in a completely different industry, and I can say, Tom, out of anyone on the show, I feel like you're meant to be doing what you're doing. What would you choose?
Your job. I'm jealous all the time. You do transactions. They're so interesting. I mean, you do like thousands of transactions, and it's like, you know, like an investment banker, but just in much more volume, right? You have the drama. It's work. I mean, the things you guys have to, you guys really have to hustle. I don't take away from that at all, but transactions are always interesting. The market's super interesting. So, you know, yeah, your line of work.
All right. Yeah. Hey, I'll take it. I agree. It's there's never a dull moment. That's for sure. Well, Tom, how can people find out more about what you're doing? It sounds like you're over on Blue Sky now. Presumably, you're definitely not on X.
I'm XX. I try to spend less time there. You know, find my recent work on blogs.ubc.ca. We've got some stuff cooking on Multiplex, on Kelowna versus Coquitlam upzonings, and Warren Biotech. So lots of stuff cooking.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for your time, Tom. That was really enlightening. So appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Tom Davidoff, associate professor at the UBC Sauder School of Business, past guest fan favorite, and all around, I'd say friend of the show.
You know, Matt, it's no wonder that Tom's such a force when it comes to people trying to have him comment on what's going on in the economy and in the real estate market. I mean, he's easy to listen to. He's got a great voice for media and radio, and super thoughtful, always entertaining to listen to him. No wonder he's one of our fan favorites for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's an understatement. Yeah, so it's great having Tom on the show. Lots of insights there. What else do we have before we cut for the day, Adam? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the LiveWire. This is our weekly mailer where we're sending out all sorts of things. VIP access to pre-sales. We're sending out deal of the month. We're sending out stats, different types of stats, sales ratios where you can dig into your neighborhood or a neighborhood you're interested in and really get granular in terms of what's selling at what price. Just fantastic stuff. That's a live wire. We also have, of course, tried and true private client services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using PCS to monitor listings in Vancouver, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, you get days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's your own personal real estate portal to monitor the real estate market. And you can sign up for your own free account over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Just click buy with us and set up your own free account today.
Absolutely. And if you want to talk about that or anything else, give me a shout at 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line. By the way, just heard from Clint Murphy.
Oh, yes.
Who might be coming back on the show, speaking of Kokomo. Anyway, the Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But just as I alluded to there, we've got a number of fantastic shows coming up. Let's just put it that way. So stay tuned and absolutely get in touch. We're always available.
Excellent. Well, have a great week and we'll see you next week.
Take care.
2000 Faces for Radio.
Subscribe today.